Welcome, everyone, to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com, the internet's leading source for news and opinions about books and film and streaming TV. I'm joined today by Book and Film Globe's chief film critic, Stephen Garrett. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Yes, so let's explain to our audience what's happened in the 7 or 8 months since we've been off the air. I left Book and Film Globe to become a senior editor at the United States edition of The Spectator, the world's oldest magazine. My term there has ended against my will. It was not performance-based. It was some sort of corporate reshuffling that I will probably never fully understand. But Book and Film Globe has brought me back from the movie critic dead, and I've been writing movie reviews for them. And Dan Friedman, who is now editing the site, has asked me to do a special edition of the Book and Film Globe podcast because everyone missed it so much. I know you missed it, Stephen.
I totally missed. I missed you, buddy.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing
you
is
our witty banter.
Yeah. I mean, I was right here. I was right here the whole time. You could call me whenever. I mean, we even saw each other in New York during the time when I was working for The Spectator. You came to a party at their offices.
True.
Their unfinished offices overlooking the Empire State Building. There were wires hanging down from the walls. And as far as I know, there are still wires hanging down from the walls. My career is hanging down from the walls there. I know. But it's okay. I am bouncing back in ways never before thought about. Some people have much worse problems than I do. And I still get to do the show from time to time, apparently. So we're gonna talk today about a couple of things. Well, first of all, we're gonna do a preview of the Oscars. I missed most of Oscar season because I had left Book and Film Globe and I was writing about politics for The Spectator. But we talked about a few of these movies before my departure. And then we're gonna also briefly steer into talking about The Bride, which is a movie from director, I guess you could call her a director, and writer, Maggie Gyllenhaal? One of those
good two. Good question. Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal.
Soft G.
I would say The Bride touches... We got it. The Bride touches on some of the nominees for this year's Oscars, given that it's a Frankenstein movie, and Frankenstein is one of the movies nominated for Best Picture. It also stars Jessie Buckley, who is nominated for Best Actress in a very different movie. So we're going to get to The Bride, and boy, do I have a lot to say about that turkey. First, we're going to talk about the Oscars, because they're coming on March 15th. We can't stop it. Conan O'Brien is hosting again, which is a good thing, I think, Stephen.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. He's a funny guy and he knows how to flatter the room while insulting them.
Yeah. And, isn't going to create a lot of political stir.
No.
He's
I doubt he will be slapped by anybody.
Yeah. Unless he slaps himself.
That's true.
All right. True. So we have Best Picture. We're going to start with Best Picture. You know, there are 10 films nominated for Best Picture. I still think that's too many, don't you? Should be five.
It's far too many.
Should be five or six. Six if there's really a good extra one. Five is we have 10. I've seen 8.5 of them. You've probably seen them all.
I have seen all of them, yes.
Yeah, I've seen 8.5. I couldn't finish Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein. I found it very ponderous.
First half was great. Second half was a snooze.
Really? Because the first half was the half I watched.
Yeah, no. Well, same for me.
Yeah,
same for me.
Yeah.
No, I watched the whole thing, but I just got tedious there at the end.
Oh, if it got tedious at the end, I can only imagine. I didn't even get to see the. It took so long for the monster that we gave up on it. The monster didn't even show up. Yeah. I didn't even see the monster.
What? Yeah. You see the monster in the first like 5 minutes.
Other than the opening scene, which is good. Opening scene in the Arctic. That's a great scene.
That's fun.
That was one of the best scenes of any movie this year. But then the rest of it is Oscar Isaac just hammered. I just don't like that actor. I don't like that actor.
Ooh.
I really don't. Ouch. All right, so we can write off Frankenstein. Frankenstein's not winning Best Picture.
Well, wait, let's unpack that a little bit. I mean, it is Guillermo del Toro. I'm surprised it went the distance as far as it did.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a lot of Netflix money.
Yeah.
Netflix has gotten very, very shrewd about campaigning. I mean, you know, they did a great job with Roma, which was the first time they kind of punctured the whole, you know, awards universe, right? And they threw a lot of money at it, but they seem to have really gotten it down. I'm impressed by how much they rolled at the red carpet for Frankenstein, how they fully committed to it. You know, it frankly is a streaming film, but it feels like a big theatrical release. I don't think they put it in a lot of theaters, but they've created an impression that this is a major blockbuster in the cultural conversation, I feel, because it keeps popping up, and I, you know, hats off to them.
All right, well, they created the impression, but it's not a blockbuster in the cultural conversation. The thing is, like, there was a movie from this year that I felt like could have taken the slot of any number of this year's Best Picture nominations, and that's Weapons, which I feel, you know, it got a nomination for Best Supporting Actress for Amy Madigan, well-deserved. But I feel like you put Weapons in this list instead of Frankenstein or F1 or, you know, The Secret Agent got a nominee for Best Foreign Film, and I think, Weapons could have taken that slot. It could also have taken... I didn't see Train Dreams. It just sounded too depressing. I didn't want to watch it. I got my own problems. I don't need to deal with some woodcutter, late 19th century, early 20th century woodcutter's problems.
You obviously have not seen the film because it takes place in the 20th century.
I said early. I did say early 20th century.
But it's pretty much... Do you know what? Let's do a little thought experiment.
Okay.
If you feel like Best Picture should be just 5 slots instead of 10.
Yes.
What are the 5 you would knock out immediately? Don't think about it. Just answer it. What are the 5 that go? Cross them out.
The Secret Agent, Train Dreams, F1, Sentimental Value, and Frankenstein.
Wow.
But maybe I didn't like Hamnet, but there's no way Hamnet is ever getting not nominated for Best Picture. So yeah, then you have a list. Then you have a list of Bugonia, Marty Supreme, Sinners, Hamnet, and One Battle After Another. And I feel that's like a pretty solid list of movies right there.
Yeah, those are the movies you put in your pocket to say, hey, 2025, these are the best movies that came out.
Other than Weapons.
Or certainly the most interesting, the most talked, like, worth discussing and seeing and revisiting, right?
Those are the movies that people saw too. I guess not as many people saw Begonia as should have, but I love Begonia. I think that movie is just so, weird and funny and sad and exciting and surprising. Great acting, yeah. Great acting from Jesse Plemons and Emma Stone, and just a really crazy and thought-provoking twist ending, and just, you know, it's like a sci-fi movie. I mean,
it's a
sci-fi movie, but it is a sci-fi movie. It's a modern sci-fi movie. It has, like, you know, modern kind of horror elements and modern absurd comedy elements. You know, the politics are sharp and funny. It's just such a great movie. I love Begonia.
Yeah, it grew on me. I have to say, before I saw it, it felt like almost like a minor niche sort of movie compared with the other ones that he did, the big swing movies, you know, which, what was the one he did with?
Poor Things.
With Emma Stone. Poor Things, which I thought was, it really broke through, and I thought it was really smart in a lot of ways, and then I also thought it was just mansplaining feminist.
Yeah, but Begonia is better. Such a great movie.
It's a lot smarter. That's the thing. Yeah, I totally agree, and... As time passed after I watched it, while I was watching it, I thought, oh, this is better than I was expecting. And it's a lot weirder and more different than I was expecting.
Yeah.
And then it stuck with me for weeks afterwards. I was like, wow, this is weird.
The ending, sequence is just haunting.
It's weirdly sad and haunting and emotional in a way I wasn't expecting. Yeah.
Really good. Really effective. You know, Marty Supreme, which we never talked about on the show because it came out after I was... I changed jobs. I really like Marty Supreme as well. That, you know, it really takes the kind of sports underdog picture and turns it inside out.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's, yeah, It's I think it was Isaac Mizrahi was presenting an award to it and said, like, this is the first ping pong movie you've ever seen with a body cam, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people die in the name of table tennis in this movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the people who are playing table tennis in the movie take it very seriously. But I also, I liked that, you know, there's a lot of table tennis. There's a lot of...
There's a lot.
But there's also a lot of sort of... it's a very Jewish movie. And there's lots of sort of immigrant Jew in New York stuff in there. And there's also, I think it's a movie like A Sentimental Value, which I like, but it's just, I just don't put it in the conversation with these films. It's a movie about, you know, generational Holocaust trauma. There's that weird scene where Marty's ping pong partner, like, they flash back to the concentration camps and he slathers himself with honey, and all the other camp visitors, attendees are licking.
But is that just ridiculous? Is that just maybe too ridiculous?
Maybe, or it could have been drawn from actual testimony of Holocaust victims. I don't know. Maybe it was a bit much, but it's not what I expected to see in a movie about an underdog ping pong player. You know, and I thought Timothée Chalamet, the kid's got range.
He's a talented guy, but he's also, I feel like, falling into the same kind of cliches that Tom Cruise did in the 80s. You know, he's always playing the cocky upstart. He's like, he's overconfident and he stumbles, but he always finds his way to, you know, excel in whatever he's doing, and maybe even becomes a messiah, depending on the culture.
Maybe.
The planet.
Maybe. You know? Perhaps. I don't know. I don't know if Tom Cruise could have played Bob Dylan, but I think that's apt. But
that's fair.
But he's a movie star. He's a movie star. He's a movie star in the same way. You know, so we've got those two. You know, Hamnet, I mean, I really, really, I've never seen a movie about William Shakespeare that I liked.
Wow.
You know, this is bad in a way that Shakespeare in Love, it's better than Shakespeare. It's a better film than Shakespeare in Love. I mean, at the same time, like, I don't really want to go to a movie to be reminded about my dead dog or my deceased mother. You know, it's a movie about, it's definitely a movie about grief and... the burden of grief and how it distorts, you know, your relationships and your mind and your emotions.
But also how you manage, how you work through it, how you express yourself, how, you know, it's cathartic, I think, in a very positive way.
Yeah, sure. But at the same time, William Shakespeare standing over the muddy Thames in, you know, in Elizabethan London, you know, having the monologue, the to be or not to be monologue, just come to him unbidden. give me a fucking break. So stupid.
The muse, buddy. Do you know?
And had Jesse Buckley's character never been to a play before? She was acting
never
like.
Been to a play before. She has no idea what it means to actually be on the stage and pretend to be somebody else.
You know, she was a smart, you know, independent person, but there's a very Mongo discovers fire moment there.
Exactly. That's my son's name. Who are you? You're not my son.
Yeah, that's so stupid.
Mongo angry.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, and it's like...
She reaches and touches the actors. Like, do not touch the actors when they're performing, please.
No.
Just don't do that.
Yeah, you're not even allowed to touch, you know, the singer when they're performing in a concert. So, but you know, and it's like, was William Shakespeare really married to a sexy witch? That's my question.
She's a wood nymph for sure.
She's a sexy.
I don't know if she's sexy.
Well, I don't know. I'm whatever.
She's
I'm
touched.
She
screams a lot. She definitely screams a lot.
Yeah, Jesse Buckley, as we've learned,
She's a
screamer, as we've learned. You know, I thought she was going to be something different. When there was that movie where she played the British woman or the Irish woman or whatever who wanted to be a country singer. That was her breakout role, or something. Rose, Ramblin' Rose, Cracklin' Rosie. I don't know what it was called.
Oh, wow!
But that was like the dawn of the Jesse Buckley era. And now we're in it, and we have to deal with her god awful performance in The Bride, which I keep bringing back. We'll talk about that in a bit.
Whoa.
All right, but
committed.
So okay, so we got two more of the top five. I think you were going to agree with my top five, right?
Yes, I mean, in terms of jettisoning, I fully agree. You don't need 10. When you have 10, that's how movies like F1, which I really enjoyed, makes it into the conversation. I think that's also where a movie like Train Dreams makes it into the conversation. Train Dreams is a lovely movie, but it's a little bit of a wisp of a movie. You know what I mean? Like, it aligns a lot of things that are going on. It has a passive protagonist that skips a huge chunk of his life without actually earning what it's like. It leans on sentimentality for the emotional potency of it. It is gorgeously photographed. It's got incredible cinematography. It's got great production. The direction is really quite nice. The script is just thin. And so Best Picture, it should not be, but that's Netflix shoving it into the conversation the way it did. Sentimental value in Secret Agent. I think I have a high bar for a foreign language film being in the Best Picture category. I don't think Best Picture should just be open to every single movie, period. Like we have, then we should get rid of the Best International Film category. Like, why have both?
Yeah.
And if we have both, you know, then have a higher bar for Best Picture. You know, like, and Parasite, I think, you know, is a good example of a high bar. Yeah. But Secret Agent is lovely. It's really fascinating. It's a real feat. It's a real accomplishment. It mixes genres. It's political in an entertaining way, in a heartbreaking way. You know, Sentimental Value, I think, is a beautiful melodrama. But Sentimental Value, I haven't felt any need to return to. It kind of went right through me. It's a prestige picture for sure. But I think to be in Best Picture, I don't feel like it needs to be there. Hamlet feels like a gimme. That's what Hollywood loves. Begonia, I think, is a real surprise, a pleasant surprise to see that make the cut. But the three that I feel are obvious ones are One Battle, Sinners, and Marty Scream. They are incredibly original, incredibly entertaining, incredibly riveting to watch. Just and so different from each other and so different from so many things that we've seen before.
Right. Well, you and I, Stephen, we talked about Sinners a lot when it came out. It really knocked our socks off, and you know, we covered it to almost exhausting extent. I don't know if there's anything more to be added to the Sinners discourse other than, you know, it remains, you know, an iconic film and will always be an iconic film. It's simply one of a kind, cannot be reproduced. You know, a Depression era vampire musical.
Gangster film,
yeah. Roadhouse.
I mean, sui generis.
Yeah, there's nothing like it, and there never will be. You know, we did not talk about One Battle After Another because that postdated my tenure at BFG. You know, I find One Battle After Another. I mean, I thought it was incredibly compelling. You know, very, very idiosyncratic. You know, it was sort of a modern version of Dr. Strangelove. You know, it's a political satire with you know, Terry Southern like writing and characters. I mean, Terry Southern and Thomas Pynchon, this book is very heavily based on Thomas Pynchon work. You know, they kind of share a similar post hippie countercultural DNA. So you know, Paul Thomas Anderson has adapted he's adapted Thomas Pynchon before with his Inherent Vice movie, which wasn't nearly as good as this one. This is, I think, loosely based on Thomas Pynchon's Vineland. But, you know, at the same time, first of all, One Battle After Another is going to win. You know,
I don't know. It depends. It's a neck and neck with Sinners.
Maybe. It's probably going to win. But, maybe. But, you know, at the same time, you know, it is. Its politics are so weird, and its protagonist is so passive. It's hard to say if it's actually gonna. I mean, if I were to pick one, my favorite of all of the list is Begonia, but it's not gonna win. It's not gonna win. So I would say, you know, if I had to pick between the two, I would pick Sinners, just because. I don't know. Haley Steinfeld's just so freaking hot in that movie.
All right. Well, one of the truisms of the Academy, which is about 10,000-11,000 members, the largest block of voters are from the Screen Actors Guild. They're actors. And what's interesting is these top two contenders, and I think it really is between the rest of the between the two of them, and everything else kind of falls away. But between the two of them, they are ensembles. They are big, deep ensembles with a lot of really interesting performances and really vivid, rich characters. And I think the actors block is going to go for that hard. So obviously, it's going to be between one or the other. And then it's a question of which one is maybe more original, which one captures the zeitgeist, which one And then which one is like, dude, do the award, which is its own narrative as well. I think, frankly, I'm biased towards One Battle because I want to see Paul Thomas Anderson have the Best Picture on his shelf. You know,
has he? Did There Will Be Blood?
He never won an Oscar.
You know, and that's funny too. You should say that because I don't think this is his Best Picture. I would take There Will Be Blood, Phantom Thread, or one of my all time favorites, Boogie Nights, over this. You know, if I had to,
I share that list, except I would swap Boogie Nights for Licorice Pizza.
Oh, I love Licorice Pizza too. Sure.
But you know what? All of those, there's always something I have an issue with his movies. And with One Battle, I have no notes. Like, it just works. I never get bored. I never lose track of anything. He is so laser focused on the plot. It's very plot driven in a way that his movies are not.
Yeah.
And yet it's still rich in the way that his movies really are. So I think it's a real accomplishment for him. But I got to say, Sinners is so weird and original and wild. That I wouldn't be unhappy with that one too. So
yeah.
I honestly, it feels like a toss up to me.
Yeah, this isn't a year where I'm going to be like, oh no, oh god, because it does happen. It does happen.
Could pull him into the pole position.
It does happen sometimes. The Best Picture winner is like, oh great, it's not going to be Train Dreams. Well, that's the thing about this year is like, Train Dreams. That's a Nomadland kind of movie. Like this is a year, if you look at the list, there are some big hit pictures, you know. Marty Supreme was pretty popular. F1 was pretty popular. Sinners was a blockbuster. One Battle After Another did very well, you know. And even
for what it was,
for what it was. So you have movies that people have actually seen. So that's kind of nice. All right, before we get to talking about this week's film of the week, because I just love doing that with you. Let's go to the best. We're just gonna do the best actor and best actress list. I think I did Timothy Chalamet won last year, right?
No,
he didn't.
No,
so he's gonna win this year. He's gonna win this Thursday. Year. He's gonna win.
I
this
don't
year.
Know. You know, Michael B. Jordan could be the spoiler if there's a Sinners sweep.
Possibly.
Leo DiCaprio, I don't think has any chance. I'm really gunning for Ethan Hawke just because he's, again, I love that actor. He's been in so many different types of things. He's been around for so long. I buy into the narrative that he's due.
He was good. He was really good in Blue Moon. He was really great in Blue Moon. That movie I thought was kind of annoying. You know, it's just, I love the third act, but like, I just it felt like I was watching a play in Chicago, and you know.
Well, fair, but I just thought it was so well written, and the way that
the end. You know, the third act. The third act is heartbreaking.
It's so heartbreaking. It's Lorenz heartbreaking. but to see his rapport with Richard Rodgers is like, God, such great writing, such great writing.
But the end, the end. I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but the end when Margaret Qualley, like, you find out why she's there, actually there. Oh, it's just, oh. Breaks my heart. All right, so all right, sure. We can give the Oscar to Ethan Hawke. That's fine. That's a very Gen X person to win it. That's like the most Gen X Oscar winner ever.
But you feel like Chalamet is going to get it. I feel like Chalamet maybe people kind of, he overstayed his welcome. He's a little too cocky.
Well, and that character's so unlikable. That character's so unlikable.
Maybe. And also, it's like again, one of these things. It would be unusual if you won it because generally. The truism is that actors under 30 almost never win Best Actor. Actresses under 30 almost always win Best Actress.
I don't think we have an actress under 30 nominated for Best Actress. Emma Stone she can't possibly be under 30, and she can't possibly win.
And she's won twice.
She can't possibly win again.
Hudson's not
going to
win.
God, please don't give it to Jesse Buckley, but they're probably going to.
It's going to be Jesse.
You know,
because look, what's the competition? Rose
Byrne. Rose Byrne and
Adam Rice, both were good in their roles.
I have to say, like, Kate Hudson isn't going to win, but I did love her in Song Sung Blue. I thought she was. I thought she was. She was really. Did you see that, the Neil Diamond musical?
I saw parts of it. I couldn't really. It's not my kind of movie, I gotta say. I hate Neil Diamond, so I'm just like.
If you hate Neil Diamond, Stephen.
I don't hate him, but I hate people who do Neil Diamond cover bands.
Yeah, well, then that's not.
That's literally the movie.
That's not the movie for you. It was definitely like a. You know, it was like the kind of, it was like a four hanky weeper about a Neil Diamond cover band. So it was very sincere. You know, but I'm, And I thought Kate Hudson was actually pretty marvelous in it. And she had it had a very like, you know, her she's run over by a car and she loses, you know.
I mean, but also I like how many I had a screener read, I kept rewinding and watching her being hit by the car, which is hilarious actually.
Yeah.
And then it is a really unintentionally hilarious moment where I'm just like, what?
Yeah, she gets hit by a car. While gardening.
Randomly.
While gardening.
And she's just standing in front of her house or something.
You know, and then Hugh Jackman keeps having these heart attacks. keeling over while singing Neil Diamond. Anyway, all right. So it's going to be Jesse Buckley. So that is our Oscar preview. And speaking,
let's do director. Let's do some of the obvious ones.
Why not?
Who do you think is going to win a lot of awards? Do you think it's going to be a sweep, or do you think they're going to split between one battle? Let's do screenplay. So original and adapted. Michael B. Jordan and
you want screen? You want to do screenplay?
No, I'm just saying they're not competing against each other, so they're both going to win. So they're both guaranteed. So honestly, if I'm curious to hear just one opinion about one category, which is director, which of those two is going to get a director?
Probably Anderson.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be I think it's going to be a sweep for one battle after another, to be honest.
Yeah.
Maybe not an act. Not a sweep in that. You know, I don't think that. Although I think Delroy Lindo is going to win for Sinners, honestly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. It's not going to be Stellan Skarsgård.
No. There's a lot of good choices. I guess what I'm saying is I honestly don't know. It's going to be a battle between those two movies, though. I think that, you know, there's going to be some.
One battle after another between those two.
After another. I don't know. It's hard to say, but I think those are the two movies to watch. All right, I want to talk about The Bride, Stephen. I know you want to.
Let's do it.
I know we're not really supposed to, but I just feel like this movie has to. We have to discuss this thing. What a strange picture this is, right?
I think that's a good thing, and I don't think it sticks the landing. But continue.
Well, what are we doing here? You know, it's like Mary Shelley awakens in some netherworld and decides to go to 1930s Chicago to possess the spirit of a prostitute who's working as a mole for the Chicago Police Department, causes her to speak in a British accent, and basically throws her down the stairs so she can die and become the bride of Frankenstein, a character that Mary Shelley never created but wants to create for the purposes of this movie. In some because she needs a female lead,
right? Because it's like a tumor of a story that's been growing and it needs to come out,
right? Even though I believe that character was created by James Whale in the 1930s, because Frankenstein was such a hit that they wanted a sequel.
So apparently it's been a while since I've read Frankenstein, but just rereading synopses and things, it seems as though The Bride is mentioned peripherally as a potential creation.
I see.
That Victor Frankenstein is mulling about giving his creation
a bride
and a companion. Right. And there is apparently a dead body that he's going to reanimate, and then he decides to like destroy both.
You're sure it's not like a dog, like a Franken dog? Franken
could be a dog.
Frankenweenie.
Frankenweenie.
Which I think is another potentially good title for The Bride, because you actually do see Frankenstein's weenie and it is stitched on, and that's really, that's super gross. But then it's like okay. You know, they for some reason Frankenstein's monster is in Chicago in the 1930s. I guess he probably bought us. I can't imagine.
For good reason, because he's been reading the writings of this mad scientist who knows how to reinvigorate dead bodies.
Oh, I thought maybe it was just because
I thought maybe Ephronius. Come on, man.
I thought maybe he was just a jazz fan or something, or like a or like a Cubs fan. So he's in Chicago. And anyway, they dig up this body and they reanimate her, and then he and the bride go out go to a transgender nightclub, which were super popular in Chicago in the 1930s. Very common, very common. You know, Ben Hecht used to write about that stuff from the old.
You Chicago. Know, I wasn't there, so I can't say if it's true or not.
Yeah,
just have the movie to go by.
Yeah, it was like it's like they walked into the Kit Kat Club, but then a couple of a couple of jamokes try to slip the bride the old Italian beef.
Heyo,
and then Frankenstein kills. Then they go on this murder rampage where they basically like travel around the country killing cops. you know?
No, because they travel around the country watching his favorite musical movie star.
Played by Jake Gyllenhaal.
An ongoing revival of this guy's movies in all the theaters in the Midwest to New York, upstate New York.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's another thing too. Is like, right. Apparently, this movie apparently seems to believe that Niagara Falls and rural Indiana are literally right next to each other, because they go back and forth without much. And even though the bride can't remember her name, she does somehow know how to drive, and they find a car.
There's that too. There's that too. And I mean, also apparently she's some sort of symbol of feminist resistance by virtue of her just being alive, I guess. And so everybody wants to ape her blonde hair, the weird smear of black ink, which is never really completely explained in any convincing way. She just seems to cough it up, and then it's a stain on her cheek like a tattoo.
Yeah, it makes it makes women want to cut out the tongues of men, because men have been cutting out their tongues. Because apparently women have been denied a voice, Stephen. They've been denied a voice.
Right.
Thank God Maggie Gyllenhaal is here to finally give women a voice.
It's unfortunate. You know what? I have to say, though, like, as I was watching it, I thought, God, this is so beautifully shot. It's so well edited. The actors are very talented, and they're giving it their all.
Sure.
This is, like, totally going for something we haven't seen before, which is, like, a weird satire, but it's also quite serious. It's like a period film, but it's a fantasy period film. Like, their version of Times Square is kind of really odd. There's like a 3D movie playing in a packed house in the 1930s.
Yeah.
There's like drive-in movie theaters that are super popular in the 30s.
Yeah.
None of this happened until the 50s. Like, maybe there were a couple like starting out, but it is such a fever dream in such an odd way. And I wanted to be there for it. I wanted to keep cutting it slack. But then at a certain point, I was like, this movie's a mess. This movie does not know how to be what it wants to be, because it doesn't know what it wants to be.
Someone should have stopped it in its tracks. The putting on the Ritz number. What a disaster.
Oh, Jesus. That's where it really lost me. I was like, the first time where we see Frank, as they call him, Frank, right?
Yeah.
Imagine himself inside, the movies that this, it's Jake Gyllenhaal playing this guy, Ronnie Reed, this Hollywood actor. He's basically like a, Fred Astaire type, right? But, I thought it was really kind of cute and lovely that Frank was imagining himself in the background as one of the dancers. And then I thought, oh, that's a sly nod to Put It on the Ritz without being so obvious about it. And then, oops, wait 20 minutes. They get really obvious about it, and they literally play Put It on the Ritz. And then Christian Bale literally screams at the end of the song, Putting on the Ritz.
Right.
And I was like, dude, what are you doing?
Right. You're basically taking one of the greatest scenes in movie history, and definitely one of the funniest scenes in movie history, making it didactic and unfunny and unentertaining. Mel Brooks is still alive, amazingly enough. And so it's like, to do that, it's just a desecration of Young Frankenstein.
I think what's so brilliant about Young Frankenstein, first of all, you never want to reference a better movie than the one that you're making, right? So you got to tread lightly whenever you do like cinematic references in movies, right? But the second thing is, like, it made me think about Mel Brooks and why Young Frankenstein worked so well. It works so well because he is so goddamn serious about being so silly. And he's like, he's meticulously like either recreated or found the original sets. I think he shot a lot of Young Frankenstein on the original sets that James Whale used for Frankenstein, right?
Yeah.
Because it was still around in the early 70s. But he is meticulous about his absurdity, right? Whereas Maggie Gyllenhaal is so slapdash about the stuff she's trying to be serious about. Like, she is silly about being serious, and he is so serious about being silly. And it just shows, obviously.
Yeah. No, this is... I think that The Bride is a surefire, just like Joker Fali Adu was, a surefire contender for the 2027 Razzie Awards. I cannot wait to see.
Unfortunately, yes.
I cannot wait to see it receive its comeuppance. And we didn't even mention it. We got to go in a second here. The ridiculous detective plot line with Peter Skarsgård and Penelope Cruz, who seemed like they just wandered in from a completely different movie.
They really did. But it's still so ham-fisted about, like, women's rights and chauvinist men being like, hey, dame, she's a dummy. She's just taking notes for me. Hey,
I just
while I'm eating a ham sandwich.
Yeah, I feel like they just kind of wander into whatever. Somehow they're there. They manage, even though they're detectives in Chicago, they have no problem getting to New York. They, you know, then they go to Indiana, then they're in Niagara Falls. It kind of just bounces around. It's like, it refers to a lot of movies that are way better than it. Not only Young Frankenstein, but also Terrence Malick's Badlands and Bonnie and Clyde.
And Bonnie and Clyde.
Not to mention every Frankenstein movie ever made. So, you know, I would rather watch an old Christopher Lee Hammer film, Frankenstein, again, than this one. So there we have it. The Bride is not getting an Oscar nomination. Stephen Garrett and I are not getting an Oscar. We should get an Oscar nomination for this podcast, Stephen. Did you miss it? Did you miss doing this?
Oscar worthy.
I think so.
We could get a Golden Globe. We could get the Golden Globe now that they have that category.
Oh, yeah. They gave it to Amy Poehler this year, but they can't give it to her every year. So,
well, or maybe they can. I don't know. It's like the Emmys. They can just keep giving, you know, the same person.
Well, this has been a special edition of the soon-to-be Webby Golden Globe award-winning Book and Film Globe podcast. Thank you, Stephen Garrett. It's always great to talk to you about anything. Usually movies.
Always a delight.
You don't really know about it. You know a lot about the movies, so you know I've learned so much.
Little about anything else.
Yeah, but you know, you're a specialist, and I'm a generalist. I'm Neil Pollack. I am the former editor in chief of Book and Film Globe. I guess I'm also the former senior editor of the U.S. edition of The Spectator. I am still the greatest living American writer. I am available for hire if you're looking for someone to write,
like kiss parties, birthday parties, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I could do. I'll show up and read from the Neil Pollack Anthology of American Literature.
Kids love that.
That's what 10-year-old Caitlin really wants for her birthday. So here comes Grandpa with his old Christopher Hitchens parodies. All right. Well, thank you so much. Please continue to read Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. It is a product of Sea of Reeds Media. And hopefully Stephen and I will talk to you soon.
We'll see.
The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Audio Hoppa.